Beyond the Cringe, episode 1, hosted by Jim Monahan, produced by You Call That Radio, mixed and mastered by Mako, recorded in front of a live studio audience at the Deep End. Thanks to Glad Radio. Enjoy the show.
You are fucking nutters, I love it.
Powered by our Patreons.
Welcome to Beyond the Cringe, my new podcast, which is going to be covering all aspects of Scottish culture. The good, the bad, the shite, etc. And we're going to be talking about the whole notion of a national culture and a Scottish culture. Is there a Scottish culture? If there is, what is it? And what does it look like in the 21st century? And, or is it much the same as anywhere else? Are cultures international now? I've got a great panel to kick us off on our first episode. We have filmmaker and author and music historian Grant McPhee, author and journalist. Journalist? Do you still say journalist? It's on your thing, your website.
I need to update that. I gave up my press and journal column a year ago, so I've not done any journalism.
Former journalist, Kirsten Innes, poet, playwright, and singer of the Glasgow Cross, Kevin Peagledy. So we're going to talk today about just a wider the Scottish culture as an idea, as a notion, and in future episodes we're going to be looking at it subject by subject, all the good subjects, Scottish television, Johnny Beattie, Scottish football, and even religion. We'll even get stuck in religion at some point. But today we're talking about Scottish culture, and I'm going to start with Grant McPhee. I said they're like a historian of some of the great moments of Scottish music. You've currently got a book out about Postcard Records. You made films like Teenage Superstars, etc. Do you think these things are, when they happen, and they're great when they happen, is there something Scottish about them? Or would they happen in anywhere else? Would they happen in Sunderland or Krakow?
No, I think in terms of, you mentioned Postcard Records, and I think they epitomise, for me, Scottishness in music, because Scotland's had a really interesting history with music, in that before the Bay City Rollers, there really wasn't a music industry in Scotland, you know, like a lot of places in the UK. And it wasn't until punk music came along in the rest of the greater part of Britain, where like independent labels sprung up. But Glasgow particularly was really unique in that punk was obviously like banned in December 1976. Sex Pistols were banned from appearing at the Apollo. And throughout the rest of the UK at this time, you had your bands also like The Clash, Sex Pistols, and you're signing to like major labels, while in Scotland, all these young kids who are like as inspired as the youngsters like from that punk moment were not, they didn't have any venues to play, so you didn't have an infrastructure like London had with pub rock, and so you had like no venues, there was like absolutely no infrastructure, there was no recording studios beyond very sort of simple folk recording studios, because like folk was obviously quite big. And for about 18 months, like Scotland was incredibly reactive to this, in that he has these just poor kids who just wanting to make this music. There's no venues to play, nowhere to record. London had zero interest in what was happening north of the border until Fast Product came out in Edinburgh. And that was like a label who, interestingly, didn't put out Scottish records. They put out records from the north of England, like Gang of Four. And Gang of Four. And what I find interesting to me is that because people in Scotland were aware of this happening. It was incredibly inspiring that a local record label was releasing records by like really cool bands that were getting fantastic reviews. And I'm a generation and a half younger than that. And when I first got into music, it was like Joy Division, which I got into first. And I was like amazed that this like record label from like Edinburgh was putting that out. And in the space of like 18 months, Fast Product put out a Scottish record by The Scars. And from Scotland not having any industry at all to be on the front of the NME with like Fast Product, it was like hugely inspiring for all of these kids. And I think when Postcard came onto that, they took that, and there was such a huge focus on Scotland like from that. And like from that moment, I think uniquely in like UK culture, it was like these people in like bedrooms that built up like record industry. Bruce Finlay with Simple Mind is like hugely important, because unlike what the Beatles did a couple of decades earlier, the UK press and the UK, as I say UK, I mean London, everything was like based in London, the publishers, record labels, everything, you had to go down to London to do that.
The first time a major Scottish band had and their management in Scotland.
Yeah.
Their bank account in Scotland, their accountant in Scotland, etc.
Absolutely, and that's like a hugely important step in Scottish music. And your Postcard, absolutely sort of like epitomised that for the youth, seeing their friends like on the front of like the NME is just like hugely inspiring. And from that, you now have like Savas Studios, you have like so much like infrastructure in Scotland, and it's all because of record labels like Postcard. And it's almost like a cliche now with Nirvana like covering like three songs by the Vaseline's, but this music did reach.
There is a picture that Douglas Stewart once shared on social media, and he's 15. And I think they're going in, it's like him and his friends are going into Glasgow, I think, busking or something. And then there's four kids in the picture, 15-year-olds, and it's Douglas from the BMX Bandits, Sean Dixon from the Soup Dragons, Norman Blake for Teenage Fan Club, and Francis McKee for the Vaseline's, and they're all hanging about together at 15. And that just happened in one wee Lanarkshire town, Bells Hill. Was that happening elsewhere in Scotland? And also, was it just much the same as what was happening, say, Hull or Leeds or St. Helens or anything else?
It's the way these things, it's almost something like magical that happens. It's all these circumstances that come together at once. A lot of people, have claimed like in Liverpool's like punk and post-punk scene, it was like The Clash playing on their White Riot tour on the 5th of May 1977, and a lot of people from Scotland would say that they first got introduced to like punk music on the 7th of May 1977, that's like 2 days later. But The Clash played in Aberdeen the day before, and it played in Hull, I think it was, on the day after, and like nothing came from that scene. So it's like, you have to have a set of circumstances. And I think one of the big things is quite often some elderly, so when I say elderly in that time, you're somebody who's 24, 25, like 3 years older, that will like listen to these people in Scotland. They never had, it was like no central like hub, like in Liverpool there's like Eric's, in Manchester they had,
in Glasgow we didn't have that.
In Edinburgh it took a while for that, and it'd be interesting to recur some things later on, like with the Arches, central hubs are so important, so like youth culture and for people
do you think there's nothing about, you said the Sex Pistols were banned. Is there something about Scotland as to why we didn't have a hub? Was it just one of the, were we kind of miserable old Calvinists and we will not have any of that?
I think the easy answer is like to say that, and it is part of it. And it was like William Aitken, the councillor at the time, he was like banning them. And I think he's had a bit of a hard time, because I think if you put everything in context, when you look at the papers, I love spending time like in the library, just going through all of these newspapers, because you start to see how things tie in together socially. And also Glasgow had a huge problem with like violence outside of music, and it's, you know, there's no argument that, you know, punk music did attract violence within the youth, and you know, I can understand that they were probably politically aware that they couldn't be seen to promote anything that would like cause, you know, or antagonize violence within the youth. And you know, so it's not really the same thing, but I think when you mentioned about like Douglas, you know, that's like an amazingly unique thing that's happened, but it could have happened in Glasgow in 1976 if you listen to your youth. You know, it's like, yeah, punk was like youth calling for something new. The famous thing is on the Bill Grundy show, which wasn't shown in Scotland, but the aftermath was on the day after when Steve Jones said, you know, you fucking rotter. And people reacted to that. It wasn't like the swearing. It was like a young person swearing but not caring on national TV. And I think that's when...
I mean, punk was very much... I mean, that's my era. I'm 61, so it's like I was those teenage kids. And it was all dead young. It was really, really young. I mean, I'm getting into buying records and being obsessed with this. I'm 14, 15. And it was 14, 15-year-old kids that was putting all these records into the charts. And they were at the top of the charts. And you're watching the Jam on Top of the Pops, and they're 18. You know, they're kids as well. You know?
It's amazing. And you're very quickly, you're from the post-career, your postcard never actually themselves managed to get something into the charts. But from, you know, the Sex Pistols signing to a major and Clash signing to a major, within a year and a half, there was like an independent record distribution set up where you didn't have to sell records through shops. And, you know, young kids like literally in bedrooms could get things into the real charts from just swapping records in different shops. And it's an aspiring thing. And I think older people, the older generation are scared of the younger generation. And I think that's something in Scottish culture that, you know, has been proven that you have to listen to your young, because, you know, so they've got better ideas.
I think that's a good thing to bring in, Kirsten, talking about the older generation and maybe the establishment being scared of the younger generation. We tragically saw the end of the Archies in a kind of moral panic, as if the things that they were blaming the Archies for didn't happen in other clubs or elsewhere. And the Archies was such a unique cultural venture, and Gat mentioned hubs.
Yeah,
the fact that it's promoted all areas of the arts, and to a certain extent was using youth culture, club culture, to subsidise other things going on as well. And you were there at the Archies during the crucial time and famously wrote a book with David Bratch piece about it.
I did, yeah. I worked at the Archies from late 2004 to 2007, but then I ran events there afterwards. So, and then, yeah, essentially I sort of missed the great flowering of it in the 90s, as it were. I came in when it was quite an established business. But what was really pretty special about the Archies was it was always a place that working class kids felt that they could access. So on my first day, my job was press and publicity manager. I was 24 years old. I was ludicrously underqualified for this position, but they were doing a trial thing where they didn't put dates of birth on the application forms at the point, and I was really good at bluffing. And Andy Arnold, who set up the Archies, sat me down on my first day and he said, "The point of this place is that we champion the right to fail. This is a space where artists can come in and try something out and not get it right, because that's very, very important to the development of artists." And it was done, a lot of things were done on a shoestring. It was a very unpretentious place, for all that there was, you know, an awful lot of experimental live art happening there that could be incredibly pretentious. It was a place where working class kids felt that they could access culture. They felt they could come in. I'm not saying that we would put on, you know, a production of Crap Last Tape in the basement and expect a load of, you know, 17-year-olds to just walk in off the streets. But we did take, you know, we would place kind of performers and live artists in the clubs and the club spaces. We would blur those boundary lines and just kind of expand that conversation a wee bit. So yeah, the Arches was an enormously important.
Writing about it when you and David wrote the book.
Yes.
Were you looking at it from the outside, looking back on it? Was it then, or did you realise at the time that just how important this is in Scotland and what a kind of major part of our culture it was?
Oh, I mean, I think I realised it when I was when the closure. We were approached to write the book, or I was approached to write the book after the publisher read a blog I think I'd written about the closure, which was, I'm not going to make any formal statements, but was, seemed, you know, there are a lot of thoughts that it was potentially done on spurious grounds, and certainly there are a lot of new developments in that area that wouldn't have been able to go ahead with a major nightclub there now. That's all I'll say. But yes, when we went through it, David and I wrote it during lockdown. So David Brachpiece was my co-writer, and he's the second longest standing Arches member of staff ever. You know, he'd been there through very much a lot of it, and he and I, we wrote it during lockdown. We did the whole thing over Zoom interviews, we interviewed everybody from people who'd worked in the bar, actors who'd been there at the beginning, we got Carl Cox at one point. He did kind of dingy me on two Zooms, and then I got him on a third one finally. But we tried to get a sort of full perspective. We wanted to tell the story of the building, and we did it as an oral history, so we let people's voices come through. The only bit of writing proper that we did was the introduction, which was to try and set the scene of this idea of Glasgow as a post-industrial space, with these massive empty areas that were gradually being filled up by artists and people who could use those spaces for cheap, could squat in them if need be, and the creative potential that can come from those spaces kind of spilling up into this making of the Arches, I suppose. Yeah.
And was that a surprise to you, that book? Was it just triggered by the fact that it closed? Was that it all happened quite quickly?
No, I mean,
Was it something you'd planned?
No, not at all. It closed. Brachy, David had been planning to write a book, and so during lockdown we all got together and had all the people who'd worked at a club called Death Disco, we had a little lockdown rave on our sofas, as you did during lockdown. And I sort of sent a message out into the group chat saying, I've just been approached to write a book. And I saw his face in the corner just go, oh no, that was my thing, that was my chance. And so, you know, it made absolute sense to bring him on board as a sort of longest term living memory of it. But yeah, it kind of came about from just kind of feeling that we needed to do something in a way, and just passing those stories on to each other.
It came just shortly after Scabby Queen, is that right? Just after it?
Yes, yeah, Scabby Queen.
Scabby Queen, I mean, albeit fictional, covers the sort of 40 years of Scottish political and pop culture.
Yes.
Right through. I mean, it's quite a... It's an incredible book. If anyone's not read it, you should definitely read it. It's an absolute great snapshot, some of which you'd have been too young to be there for, taking you through sort of poll tax campaigns and right through the Scottish referendum, and covers of a wide aspect of Scottish culture. And I think the last time I interviewed you, you told me you were writing a play about a Scottish country darkness class.
I am. Well, I was wondering,
Scotland your thing? So the Arches, the whole political culture, the poll tax, is Scotland your big inspiration?
I'm like a stick of rock with a salt tire right down the middle, basically.
Oh, really? Just like the biscuit I've got here.
Just like your salt tire biscuit.
I have a salt tire empire biscuit here. It's fucking magic.
Yeah, I mean, so for me, when I've been kind of asked this question or something like this question before, and I always kind of put it up to a wee accident of luck of the point at when I was born. So I was 13 when Trainspotting came out. And
I think you could say you were 13 when you were born.
When I was born, yes, I've always been an old soul. I was 13 when Trainspotting came out, and so I was a wee bit too young to read that. But just as I was wanting to read something more than The Babysitter's Club or Sweet Valley High or Point Horror that teenagers read, there was this massive flowering in Scottish literature caused by the market forces of Trainspotting in London suddenly going, oh, hello, this might be a popular thing.
Yeah, we all need a Scottish book.
But at the same time, so that opened up this world to me, that the books that I was reading as a young adult were, you know, the likes of A.L. Kennedy, Ali Smith, Jackie Kay, James Kelman, Duncan MacLean, Irvin Welsh, obviously. I was the generation who Irvin Welsh was banned for your RPR. And also my mum was, she was big into Scottish theatre. That was her big thing. She was a full-on Wildcat and 784 supporter. So the first proper adult theatre show I remember being taken to was Border Warfare, which was in the tramway before it was the tramway. And it was like a 4-hour using the entire space of the tramway to retell the entire relationship between Scotland and England from, you know, Pictish time to Margaret Thatcher. And all of these things made an impression on me and how I thought about the world. And so for me, it just kind of, it seems to be where I'm coming from. So yeah, my first novel could potentially be many places, but Scabby Queen was very, it is very, very Scottish of its way. It just seems to kind of come through me like that. I can come back to the Scottish country dance in a wee bit later. But
that is a really good part. It's a Scottish history book, even though it's fictional. And the characters are fictional, but it's you're reading through it, it's all so familiar. You know all of it. You know the characters in it. It's like the people that I've been lived my life with during those same 40 years in those same sort of places, and it's a fantastic book for that reason, I think. And it is very, very Scottish without it being, I mean, there's no Empire Biscuits and Square Sausage, but it is of modern Scottish culture. So a great snapshot, I think. Kevin, I'm going to ask you about one of your shows. Kevin, there's these great one-man shows, if you ever get a chance to see them. And one of them was a sort of seminar-based thing that he did at the Fringe called, and elsewhere, called Suffering from Scottishness. Is that, do you think Scottishness is something that defines you, defines your work a bit, or at least influences it? Or do you think if you were across the water, you could be suffering from Irishness?
I think that, like, national identity is an inspiration for you, wherever you're from, I think. But I do think there is unique kind of attributes to Scottishness that maybe are quite ripe for translating artistically. You know, history, culture, the political paradox of Scottishness and Britishness and how those things sit beside each other, the gap between how we see ourselves and how other people see us. I think all that's like, yeah, other countries might have their version of it, but I think the Scottish version is very kind of prime, and it's like up front for us.
So in the show, were you was it sort of self-deprecating, was it that sort of thing, or was it a kind of a funny look at Scottish culture, or were you sort of celebrating it as well?
I mean, if you've seen any of my shows, you know they kind of start with it being funny and nice until I can get you kind of relaxed, and then I can hit you with the hard stuff and make you feel quite upset about yourself. So there was a bit of that. I mean, the idea was that I was a representative of a government kind of agency, and we were going to create a Scottish citizenship test, and I was there to kind of workshop it and work out what questions might end up in a citizenship test. So it was funny because it was that interactive element of it as well, because the audience got to vote aye or no as to what questions went in and what ones didn't.
What was the worst one that went in?
I think that people were obsessed with the idea of bravery, which I thought was something that isn't even Scottish, do you know what I mean? But is obviously just like kind of...
Is that bravery, or would, I mean, feel free to join in or chip in, is that bravery, or is it just like mental, as we would call it in that
exactly.
thing? Exactly. I don't like to be disabled, but in a Glasgow version of mental. Somebody once said to me that everybody in Glasgow knows somebody that died immediately following the words, "Here, watch this." And so I don't know if that's bravery or no.
Well, that's it. Is it bravery to wear shorts during winter? Do you know what I mean? Or is it just a bad idea?
Aye. Any questions you would add to the Scottish citizenship test, Kirsten or Grant, would you?
I was thinking about the word Gallus there instead of bravery for a sec.
Oh, yeah, that's probably better, right?
Yeah.
Bravery you just associate with, you know, like some really stupid story of some military guy that led his troops to death.
Well, that element of the show came with me kind of singing a song about... the guy who kicked the terrorist in the balls when he was on fire at Glasgow Airport. Which, you know, that guy kind of became an icon of, like, Scottish bravery. But actually, that was a really stupid thing to do.
Like, was I.
Objectively.
That whole thing was stupid, though, because the terrorist guy with just some petrol in a motor or something like that, half a bomb that he's half made in his garage, driving it into some concrete, like bollards, so he can't really get into the airport in the first place. Hadn't he thought it through?
It wasn't great. He was a doctor as well. You
the
think
security,
he would...
was? Just, I didn't even think that guy was a security guy, was he?
No, I think he was
a taxi driver.
Baggage handler?
Baggage handler, that's right.
That's right.
What was the baggage handler doing out the front here?
He was definitely smoking, wasn't he?
John Smeaton. John Smeaton, wasn't it?
That's John Smeaton, that's the guy.
He was outside having a fag and just saw this Gerrard guy. For
I'll go kick him.
I'll just boot him.
I mean, I suppose you could say that all bravery's got to have an aspect of stupidity behind it.
Yeah, perhaps.
Aye, so I think we're getting to. I think we get to the point where defining someone here as that the Scottish version of bravery is just fucking daftness.
Yes.
Just,
but there's that idea of, like, you know, one of the things in the show is the idea of Caledonian anti-syzygy, which is a kind of concept that was invented to talk about Scottish literature. And I think it came about because of, like, kind of Jekyll and Hyde, the idea that the Scottish identity is always caught between two binary points. And even, like, you know, kind of Catholic, Protestant, Scottish and British, you know, Celtic and Rangers, Glasgow and Edinburgh, it's like there's always kind of two opposing points and we're kind of existing in between them. And I think that's really quite interesting when I come to define Scottish culture and Scottish identity. I always go, oh, it's never one thing, it's a tension between two things. That's where it sits. And that's maybe why we always feel a wee bit uncomfortable with ourselves. Because
there is James McMillan once did a speech at the Edinburgh Festival, which was dead controversial, because I think it was every certain interpreter who was saying that Scotland was institutionally anti-Catholic or something. But what he was really saying was that we have this thing in Scotland where, as a sort of Presbyterian Calvinist country, we're a wee bit suspicious of flamboyance and colour, and Catholicism's a wee bit flamboyant and colourful and all that kind of stuff. So that sort of Calvinist attitude had sort of repressed the arts in Scotland, but it was also hand in hand and part of an anti-Catholic kind of thing, because it's like, that's what Catholics do that kind of thing. So it was always like, just don't show off, don't do anything that affected the arts badly. And I think it'd be, because it's Scotland, there was nobody read it with any nuance. what are you trying to say? I think it ended up with one of them. He got a lot of criticism, which I thought was unjust. There's plenty of reasons to criticise James O'Millan, if you want, anyway. I've got a few. Anyway, it's a few streets away from me in Cumnock, actually. Working class boy for a council house in Cumnock, and look at them now. Anyway, like any nation, I think, right, we've got our culture, right? There is a Scottish culture. We've got traditions, we've got customs, we've got our own religion, the Church of Scotland, we've got our own languages, Gaelic, Scots, we've got cultural icons like Billy Connolly, Sean Connery, Robbie Burns. But what about Scottish culture? Is there a specific thing that you could describe us? When I worked in London, somebody asked me, what about Scotland stuff? If you hear, and I said, you can buy fags at the ice cream van. and which they thought was mental. They thought, really? You can buy Henin ice cream van, you can buy tomato sauce if you want, or in. And then tea bags. They thought I was mental, but buying fags at an ice cream van. Although there's been worse things sold at ice cream vans than Glasgow.
Yes.
So you're at an international writers' conference, and I'm going to say Morocco. Don't know why, but it's in Morocco, just to make it as far away for Scotland. Nobody in Morocco's ever seen Johnny B, right? And so you're in Morocco, and somebody says to you, tell me about Scotland. Tell me something that sums up Scotland, right? So not the fags or the heroin at the ice cream van. What would you say, Kirsten, if you were asked that at this conference?
I was thinking, I think we're still quite connected to a folk tradition. The thing that fascinates me about Scottish country dancing that I need to write something with at some point, I want to do something with it at some point, is that every child who went to school in Scotland has a physical memory of these dances. If I said to you two just now, get up and give me a gay Gordon's around that table, you could do it. It would take you a couple of things, but you go 1, 2, 3, turn back 2, 3. It's this sort of inbuilt physical memory of these dances. And then there's also, Burns Day, Burns Night just came there, and I've got 2 primary school age children, and they've been memorising these poems, and we had a wee party with some pals, and all the kids stood up and did their poems that they've all learned in their classes. That's quite, it's quite in touch with ourselves. I mean, I think it's possibly because we're a wee bit obsessed with ourselves, but there's still something there. That's what I would come to in terms of an exceptionalist idea.
We still do have these traditions.
Yeah.
The Halloween's always one that gets me, because everybody starts doing trick or treat thing. And I thought, we've not been doing that in Scotland.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
For centuries as guys, and rather than. And I'm not that bothered about, whether they change the word and all, but I just thought, there's people here who their kids have been getting a new history of that, as if it's something that's came from America in the last 20 years rather than something we've always done.
We did. Yeah, I think we did actually import it to America.
Yeah. Hogmanay as well. People talk about New Year, but it's Hogmanay is the important thing to us. New Year's the hangover, isn't it? I've also thought that's why steak pie. That's why steak pie on New Year's Day, because you've got a hangover. You can actually, you've just bought it already made at the butcher's. You just put it in the oven and lie back down on the couch, and then 20 minutes later, you just got a giant spoon and eat your steak pie. That's what I do.
Carbs and salt, it's good for soaking up the...
Kevin, that you're at the Moroccan International Writers Festival, you're thinking, why have they asked me to Morocco? No, you're thinking, you've been told tell us about Scotland, Kevin. What's the unique thing about Scotland?
It's a nostalgic culture, I think. I think we do look back a lot, and I think there is a hell of a lot of self-mythologising as well, and kind of, I think Glasgow specifically is really bad for it, nearly as bad as Ayrshire, which is the idea of kind of making that myth of yourself and kind of building stories around it and then retelling that story enough times that it becomes a kind of fact. So I think that nostalgia and that looking back is a big part of the identity. Being self-deprecating.
Why do we look back? Do we think it was better before or something? Or
I don't know. I think there is an assumption it was better before, but actually all anybody does is moan about what it was like before as well. So it was terrible before and now, basically.
Aye. Yesterday when it was raining, it was terrible. Now that it's sunny, it's terrible.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of sums it up.
I suppose you look back to know yourself, don't you, though? Knowing yourself is rooted, and that's nostalgia. Well,
do you think that's part of it? Maybe we don't know ourselves and we're always looking back because... Now, I don't want to get too... Well, I do want to get too political here. Is it because we're not like an independent nation? Are we always sort of thinking, who the hell are we, who the hell are we, and questioning it?
Well, the interesting thing with that, I was going to say myth. First I was going to say, Scotland's like a dysfunctional family going into what you... So before, I think it's true, but myths are so important for any culture. And when Ireland became independent, it's like De Valera recreated this myth of Ireland as, from being like this powerhouse of industry to recreating it as some sort of rural land of fairies, and the writers were with that. But I think there is something deeply within this, and if it's like you're saying, there is like a sort of an archetype of your land, and I think because like Scotland, Ireland, like are so similar, like socially and, you know, like geographically, I think we do have that bit, and it's like what were Scott, like, you know, part recreated that sort of myth for us in the 19th century. And I think, you know, anything, I think it's like I was talking about music earlier on and bands that people are really into, there's like a myth about it. There's like something beyond just this sort of practicality of making music. And I think there's just something that people have this need for mythologizing something and to buy into something, you need to create a myth, and it can be quite dangerous.
Creating a myth is probably just part of creating a story, creating your identity that we don't. Maybe we're confused a wee bit as a nation as to who we are and what we are.
I think so. And I think here with, you know, Ireland, they had like this sort of cut off, and they just like changed their history, and people bought into. You know, when you think of Ireland now, it is, you know, like dancing and like river dance and stuff like that. You know, that stuff that's just like made up. But it can be dangerous. Like, you know, on like Facebook, there's all those like accounts about, you know, how great it was like in the 70s. Remember when we woke up and we had no heating and, you know, stuff like that, how great it was.
It is mad
stuff. And, you know, there's like serious, you know, there's you know, the people.
Yeah, you stood in a nail, you're in the border with a tetanus jagger and like, you
know, remember polio.
That's it. Parents threw you at the house, went away to work, and you just wandered the streets all day, you know, that was great.
But it's like a, you know, nostalgia, you know, they used to call nostalgia like a mental illness, you know, that it was something that, you know, people would be get sent to like bed, so you had to get over their like nostalgia. But I kind of, you know, it concerns me that that there is this sort of like spate of like thinking, you know, like 30, 40 years ago was like a great time, because I think the people that are promoting that have like ulterior intentions.
Every photograph from the 80s from any sort of working class community, anywhere in Britain, but definitely Scotland, definitely Glasgow, any picture from the 80s, it looks like a war zone.
Yeah.
It looks absolutely terrible. The buildings are in terrible condition, falling apart. The playgrounds are just a bit of landmass, a bit of land where there used to be a block of flats that fell down, and that's where the kids are playing and all that.
The Belgian photographer,
not just him, but whose name I can never remember. Is it Depardon?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, but
something like that. Made great pictures, but just in general, if you see pictures with Sunderland or Edinburgh or even any of the new towns like Irvine and all that kind of stuff at the time, just people walking around concrete jungles, but great art came out of that time. But you mentioned earlier about the, you know, Walter Scott and all that. I used to run a wee festival called the Green Shutters Festival of Working Class Writing, and it was based on the House of the Green Shutters, which was a fantastic book by George Douglas Brown, and that was a sort of the kind of attack at that. What was it, Kailyard, they would call that kind of stuff, Kailyard. And it's a working class novel set in a working class town where the trains are coming and it's going to change all the industry and all that. Everybody's gossiping about everybody in all the wee pubs. It's set down my way. It's set in a fictional village which is supposedly near Cumnock kind of thing. It's actually a relative for Charles Douglas Brown. Tell you that enough time though.
Him and Macbeth.
And true story. But there was a sort of fight back to that. The way that punk rock was a sort of fight back to stadium rock and all that kind of stuff, and it created the landscape where you would then in the 20th century as writers became more working class themes, working class writers, to the time that Kirsten was talking about when we had a boom and like people like Kelman and Irvine Welsh and Janice Galloway and all that, all writing about Alan Warner, all writing about the same time, and changes the story again. If you're writing a story now in the 21st century, which story does it tell? Is it a story of hard men and like dark, bleak landscapes? Is it a story of the country and our natural heritage? Is it a story of like heroin? What's the story of, or as it has been before, what's the story of Scotland now? If a group of, and it's a difficult question, but if a group of new novelists appeared with a wave like we had then, or we had back then, what would they be? What would they be mythologizing about? What would their theme be?
I think it's important to acknowledge that there is a shift away from a single monolithic idea of national identity, because that can become too. I mean, I always remember this Janice Galloway quote from when Irvin Welsh and Alan Warner and Duncan MacLean were on this tour of America, and it was like the shocking Scots, to you know, and she said, yeah, I've quoted this a couple of times, so I'm trying to remember it word perfect. The chaps and their priorities were Scotland, as far as the New Yorker was concerned. I wanted to write and say, oh, hiya, there's women over here too. We're taking prescription drugs, if any. But then there's, and Ali Smith as well, she said that Scotland got, well, we've defined ourselves for so long as not English, as separate to English, that we kind of forget that there's other kinds of separateness, other kinds of otherness within our own national identity as well. I'm interested in a kind of just that sort of hope, bringing out a plurality of voice. And as somebody who doesn't live in either Glasgow or Edinburgh as well, and in kind of non-central belt stories coming out, non-stories from those two big cities. So let's hear from, I think we've spoken a lot about Glasgow today, yeah. But you know, we're not really, and Kevin, you said, oh, there's this Glasgow versus Edinburgh, the Caledonian Aunties I gave. I was thinking about the whole massive north of it there, yeah, that, you know, yeah, as well. Like,
well, I mean, I'm from Ayrshire. Where I was brought up was heavy industry in the middle of the countryside. That's what coal mines were, steels, all those things were just basically that. Whenever you lived in the east of Ayrshire anyway, you lived there because a village existed because of a coal mine, and everybody had kind of shared interest in that one way or another. And but you lived in the country. You didn't live, it was an industrial town, but you're literally seconds away. You just go around the corner and there's a farm.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of difference. And growing up, you grow up outside, basically. In Glasgow, when you say you grow up outside, you grow up, that's standing at a corner or whatever, that, you know, you're really outside. In Ayrshire, I always felt, I know loads of people say this about Ayrshire, that the sky is almost like part of you, you know, it's like you don't have to look up to see the sky like you do if you live in Glasgow. You just, it's there, it's virtually all around you, kind of thing. And so there is a, and I think there's great stories to be told about that, the landscape idea, which I believe is your next book, is it?
Yeah,
I didn't see any plugs, but tell us a wee bit about it, you know, about the land thing, you know.
You gave me up on you because it's narrated by the Renfrewshire countryside, essentially dealing, and it does not like humans, and it's dealing with thousands of years of human ownership.
So humans like bed bugs or something.
We bet, aye.
So I was going to, moving on to some questions for you again, back to some questions. I was going to ask, in terms of Scottish culture, and now or in the past or whenever, what Kevin, I'll ask you first, what are we good at? What is it we're best at?
I think we are exceptionally well attuned at taking the piss and at ourselves and everything else. And I mean that, I don't mean that as any kind of like put down or insult. I mean that that is a skill that we have, and we're very, very good at it, and we're well trained in it. Do you know what I mean? That's from birth that you learn those skills and sharpen them.
You've got to get in there before somebody else can.
Of course, it's part of the fun of it. And
so it's sort of armour.
Yeah, and I think that when it's in good jest, I think that we are very, very good at that. And the translation of that into our art, you know, you're talking about Billy Connolly earlier and stuff, but even, you know, modern kind of stand-up in Scotland, I think, is pretty exceptional. And some of our TV shows, although, you know, the quality's maybe declined in recent years, but I think when I think of Scottish TV, I think of Scottish comedy. And I think that in terms of our culture, I think that that's something that defines us, and actually is a very positive thing, is our ability to look at ourselves and poke fun and have a laugh. And
are we as good at letting other people poke fun as us?
Oh no, we're far too sensitive for that.
Do So, I mean, that's it. Every time I see somebody English talking about deep fried Mars bars, I'm like, what are you talking about?
I know, that's the worst chat though, isn't it? Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I think that it's like, you know, you have to be part of the club to be able to tell the joke. And yeah, if you're not part
if
of the
joke's
club,
directly aimed at you, it's even better. I think that's I went to see Christopher MacArthur Boyd once, and I had bad sciatic at the time, so I was really, really struggling with my walking. And then part of the show, he said that Scottish men of a certain age have the posture of a prawn cracker, and I thought, that is exactly me walking up here. That was me, just aimed right at me. What are we good at, Grant?
I think Scotland's historically been great at producing like mavericks, like individuals, you know, especially in sort of like managerial roles, you know, whether good or bad, you know, like in football, it's remarkable. You know, you're talking about you know, Bell's Hill, but you know, you have like the three football managers from Liverpool, Manchester United, and like Celtic, you know, all creating, you know, like great tunes. You know, I should never be talking about it. I know nothing about football, so it's like bad.
Yeah, Charlie's not for Bell's Hill, no.
And
but I know what you mean.
But for Larry, sure.
yeah, from like Larry, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And you know, in terms of like people being involved in, you know, like the army, you have like, you know, people like David Stirling, some crazy guy who invented SAS, and you know, there's like something within Scotland where they're like very good at infiltrating and like bossing people around, whether it's a good
and influencing the culture.
Influencing the culture, yeah. I think Scotland, like a lot of, you know, it's almost like a big like seaport, you know, in places like, you know, Liverpool and, you know, like New York, where people can be very sort of like transient, like people can like sort of like flow through. And I think Scotland has been like great at having these mavericks go out into the world, you know, in terms of like, you know, not necessarily doing things in Scotland, but people from Scotland and, you know, part of that Scottish culture going to other places, yeah, and, you know, creating something, you know, amazing. You know, it's like the great like invention, like sort of like TV and the telephone and all the medical inventions. You know, they weren't invented in Scotland, but it was like Scots.
Did we even invent them though? That's the thing about culture.
Is it?
There used to be a tea towel my granny had. The tea towel listed all the things that Scottish people invented. And I always thought to myself, you know, we probably didn't. We've probably invented the idea that we invented everything.
Yeah.
Now, and I know that everybody lays claim to, there's loads of different nationalities lay claim to the telephone and the television and all that kind of stuff. But do we invent stories about ourselves that make us superior? Are we a kind of do we have to see ourselves as kind of, you know, like almost like the better than others? We're better at inventing things, we're better at fighting, we're better at fibbing, or
try to make ourselves feel better, right?
Is that because we live next door to somebody who's probably,
it's like
better than us at things?
Yeah, I think it's honestly as simple as that. I think it's like being like constantly compared,
yeah,
to somebody else,
or I mean, forgotten about and trying to,
exactly, trying to go, it's me, but he
unlocks something, you know, there's like an underdog sort of like spirit, and I think that's like a really positive thing. In,
do you think that's in Scotland rather than Scottish people, that's in Scotland and the culture? Because I'm thinking we do have, like, in saying the arts, you mentioned Ella Randy Arnold, there's people come along who instigate things, and I was thinking David Gregg at Elisa, we need like the revolutionised Scottish theatre. Is David's not Scottish, is he? Is he?
I can't remember.
I think he is.
Is he?
I think so.
Or did he come? You're from England, from a theatre in England or something?
Potentially, but I mean, I think he's always been.
I only
been...
ask that because it's his idea to call this podcast Beyond the Cringe as well.
Thank you, David. But I'm sorry, I can't remember what your accent sounds like right now.
But if people come here from elsewhere, Scotland has that culture for them as well. It's not a thing that's inherent in Scottish people.
It's that transient thing. It's like the person who, you know, started the Traverse Theatre in like Edinburgh, Jim, can't remember his surname.
Jim, he used to do these amazing parties in Paris.
Yeah,
I went to one of them once, Moustache. died. Sorry, this is terrible, like a couple of years ago,
he was involved in like international times, all these amazing counterculture things, and but you know them just sort of like going through Scotland for a brief period of time, it just like influences people, and you know that's as important to me. I don't think matters where somebody's born. It's like, you know, as part of your culture, it's just like people coming through. This like transient nature of like being a port, I think, is something that's fascinating.
I think a lot of people, especially like in the last 10 or so years, have been really attracted to that mythology of Scotland and moved here because of that. And I remember going to see Josie Long like ages ago, and she'd done a whole bit about how she was like, oh, I'm obsessed with Scotland. I'm going to move there one day. And everybody was laughing. And then I think she lives here now. So.
She made a film, I think, called Let Us. Josie's going to be a guest in a later show. She lives quite near here, actually. She was she made a film. I can't remember what it was called. It was a short film. And the character was her. And she'd moved to Glasgow because it was going to change her life. And I think it was in the Disneyland, she calls, I'm just going to Glasgow and I'm just going to go and hang around with Belle and Sebastian and all that stuff. It's going to be great because that's what Glasgow is. And of course, it's mainly her sitting in a cafe on her own, lonely and all that kind of stuff. But she did move to Scotland, and not only that, her kids were born in Scotland and they're ginger. So there must be something, not just in the culture, something.
The water, now we're putting it in the water with
something
the food
in the water as well.
Belle and Sebastian are fascinating. They've like created their whole mythology themselves, where they're record sleeves, and that is something, you know, when I was in New York, that's what people talk about, Belle and Sebastian, you know, it's like this tiny indie band from Glasgow are huge, and you just like created this glamorous...
I'm not claiming them for yourself, but Stuart's for yourself, I think Stuart's mother for yourself.
But
yeah, absolutely,
like,
yeah.
They've created, so, you know, it's like, it's not real, you know, Glasgow's not like this. Yeah, hanging around in sort of like midnight cafes and stuff, but people do come to like Scotland because of that, and I think that's fascinating.
I think it was Elaine and Gyro baby song, Mark, isn't it? Over here in the West End, says the guy for Belle and Sebastian's his best friend.
Yeah, but I think there's that size of us though, isn't it? I mean, the fact is that we're a tiny, tiny, tiny wee place. Everybody knows somebody.
Yeah.
And it makes it much easier to have that kind of, you know, I was a massive Belle and Sebastian fan when I was a teenager, and now my eldest son's godmother, she's also the godmother to Stuart Murdoch's son. You know, this sort of like it's the smallness of it makes it very easy for people to connect and know each other, as opposed to a place like London, which is just this sort of, you know, people traditionally, maybe Scots used to move to London if they wanted to work in the creative industries, but apart from maybe actors, I don't think that's as essential a thing to do.
Yeah.
Anymore. And it makes us a bit more humble. You don't get that sort of I am the great artist so much. Maybe, you know, I am, you know, we can self-deprecate. It keeps you humble. It's a small pond. I don't know, maybe those kind of things work for something, whether you were born here or
so
not.
So what are we good at? What are we best at?
What are we best at? Self-mythologizing.
What are we shite at?
We are shite at acknowledging wider forms of difference, and I also think we're pretty shite at taking accountability for negative aspects of Scottish influence throughout the globe.
For the empire and
the empire, the empire's a pretty easy one to handle.
Tobacco and sugar trades and
boy made us do it kind of thing. Absolutely. The sugar trade, I mean, look at the whole of the merchant city in Glasgow, what that was built on the back of, you know, whose backs that was built on.
On the sugar plantations. And
I think even the fact that it's called the merchant city, I think it's quite horrible. Because we know what kind of merchants they were.
You know.
We know what their merchandise was. We know that the boats going that way, or maybe bringing sugar by the boats when they went that way, brought slaves. We see the merchant city as if that makes it a kind of smart sounding place.
I think people were really shielded from that for years, though. I think honestly, they've done
that
great.
Isn't that a recent thing? Was it always called Merchant City?
No,
it's been called the Merchant City for a long time.
Yeah,
it's got all their big.
I'm 61. When I say recent, I mean I don't remember being called the Merchant City when I was a kid or young. When I was younger,
no, I think when they'd done it up, they were like, "Oh, we need a name for this," and obviously, like Stockwell Street was like there and stuff. But
I think it was. My first job when I left the List magazine was social media person for the Merchant City. Yeah. Lasted 2 months. It was not for me, but yeah.
The Bastard City or something like that.
The Bastard City would be. I'd go there. I definitely. I don't
you'd go for a pint in Bastard City.
Merchant City was meant to be that hour. So this is where all the, do you know, the people that are in the new industries are going to be hanging around having lunch at Pret and all that stuff. It's actually just full of mad Fenian pubs. That's basically it now. It's just everybody, it's just pub after pub after pub, one guy in a guitar singing an IRA song, others are drunk guys staggering about the flare, and that's basically the Merchant City.
Great, like, marble columns and statues of all of these slave traders. Oh.
We do have them, don't we? Do we? Do we have statues of these guys? I don't. Does anybody know what the statues are? Talking about an iconic Glasgow and an iconic Scottish setting, George Square. Does anybody know what any of these statues are? Any
yes.
of the people in them?
Well, one of them is a guy who invented the modern police force.
All right, yeah.
Was his name Peel? Which is what? Which is where they, I think they originally, you know, in old films, they'd call the police Peelers.
Aye, they're doing sometimes in Ireland and in Liverpool,
yeah.
I think.
It came from him. So one of his statues is there, which is the one that all the fascists were very interested in protecting last time.
She's Scottish, is there any connections?
It has to be Scottish.
Did they invent police? We invented the bullet.
We invented the police,
man. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. There's Robbie Burns is up there somewhere in George Square, isn't he? He's kicking about in George Square.
Is he going to hazard a guess that none of them are women?
Absolutely not, no.
Any women in statues? Is there any women in statues anywhere in Scotland other than La Passionara, who's not even Scottish?
The Mary Barber.
There's
and
Mary Barber, who's from
the Mary Govan. Barber one, I find quite disturbing, though. Because it's a very small Mary Barber with a whole load of people who are increasingly smaller, as it like Russell
until she's got borrowers in the fallen.
I don't know if you walked past, if you came out of Govan bus station and walked past that statue and somebody said, have you seen the statue of Mary? And you go, oh, look, it's Mary Poppins. That's what I thought when I saw it. It doesn't say to me, this is a powerful woman who not only took on local government and national government and beat them, became the first female provost of Glasgow. It just looks like there's the wee woman with wains following her. And I was a bit disappointed with that one, to be honest though.
There's a lot of naked women on statues up and down Paisley High, around the cathedral.
That?
Yeah, a lot of naked women in Paisley, and all of them have got like, I'm not entirely sure, and they're all like kind of, they've got like the names of the big mill owners and things on them, but it's not, you know, they were not naked women. They were, you know, they were men. They've got the men's names on them. This was dedicated to the memory
The big mill owners was called Coach. You think you could have given her one to
I think he's
you know
got
what
one.
I mean?
He's got one especially as well, but then he's also here. Maybe got one. Yeah. Oh, like a coat.
It was a Coach joke.
Sorry. Yeah. It was a Coach joke and do you want to do that again?
The main thread, though, they didn't actually make Coats, but, you know, it was there's a lovely big church. It was just called Coats, the Coats something church. It's beautiful, just off the city centre. I don't know, streets in Paisley and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Coats, the Baptist church
Coats
or something.
Memorial
like that.
Church. Is that the one with the angel?
Yes. Yeah, it sits back just from the main, is it Causey Side Street? If you turn just off it, so it's wonderful. And it's funded by them. For them, I think it might even be in their own church, the Coates Baptist Church. Why not have your own church if you own everything else? If you own the mill, land, the houses, and the shops. So, Grant, what are we shite at?
I think Cruel Kirsten in the accountability. I think there are huge problems, and I think really, probably in the post-independence debate, there's like a huge division which isn't really sort of fully addressed, and I think that's causing lots of problems for our country. Going back to like the dysfunctional family and what you were saying about, you know, there is something in between, and I think until that addressed, I think Twitter has just been, you know, regardless of that, terrible for culture, because everything is just put into, you know, almost like headlines. It's either, and you have to be like yes or no. There's like no grey, you know, hierarchy, no in between sort of, as you know, we need. And I think we have like, you know, it's almost like an irony with trying to find what is Scotchness. You know, I've seen like some people like anything that's sort of like you're promoting Scottish culture, you know, people hate it because it's like, you know, too like Scottish. And I think until that's like addressed, I think we're like terrible at fighting each other.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Actually, and I notice that with languages a lot. Do you know, some they'll put Gaelic signage up somewhere, and the people, there's people who are against that, and I never know why, because they never say why. They just call that, oh my God, you put Gaelic signs up, it's a waste of money. And you're thinking, why are you not bothered?
It's woke.
Why do you care? If you don't speak Gaelic, you don't need to read it.
That's the same people who use that cry laughing emoji to react to.
Yeah. Oh, I use that. Is that not cool?
Oh.
I said, well, you're one of the guys.
I use it.
I was getting worried for a second, or something.
No, just that kind of it sums everything up. That one wee picture to me, that it's just a default response and it negates anything.
We are
not good at sitting with earnestness, which is coming from the self deprecation. But it's flipped round a wee bit. But you know, sometimes you do need a wee bit of earnestness, and you know, to just be able to dismiss everything as woke with a cry laugh emoji. I'm sure you use it in a very different way, Jonathan, as mine.
Oh, probably not. No. Have I ever sent you one? Don't misread it, please. Right, I've got a final question. All right, for time, I think. We've been here. What I don't like doing this podcast is bore people and gone too long, because see, when I start talking about this thing, especially with people like yourselves who are interesting people, this could be a 7-hour podcast very easily. But I'm going to ask a final question, and it's a tough one. Scotland's independence, newly independent Scotland, and the first minister of the newly independent Scotland, well, shall be called the first minister. I said he, because it will be a he, won't it? Usually is. Whatever they're called, the prime minister of Scotland, says, Kirsten Innes.
Hello.
You're my new cultural secretary. Give me a big idea. What's your big policy idea that's going to boost Scottish culture or help Scottish culture?
This is not a tough question at all. I would say have a look at Ireland, right? Have a look at the absolute constellation of stars, but particularly Irish writing, just because that's my wee area. You know, you've got your Sally Rooney's, your Colm Tobin's. That is a country that punches massively above its weight. And what does it do? It has tax breaks for artists.
Tax breaks for artists.
Tax breaks for artists. But I also, having said that, there's a wee bit of me that's like, oh, you think you're good, do you, as an artist, do you? You think you deserve not to pay tax?
Can't you feel
it? And I've got this sort of internal that it is my moral responsibility to pay tax as well, to contribute. What Ireland has done, I was asked to go over there.
They do have a thing, it's not just tax breaks. I think there's also a kind of benefit thing as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's a like tax that. Credit in reverse.
Yes, tax credit. As well. Yeah.
So if you're earning well, you do get tax breaks. But in the times you're not earning, because artists are all freelancers, loads of times you're not earning, you will get some sort of allowance. I can't know what it's called, but
I think that's what I'm thinking of more than tax breaks, which now I'm saying it sounds very glib and just let me not pay tax because I read books. No, it is that sort of helping
support there.
Writers who, well, you know, artists who need the time, like Andy Arnold said, the right to fail, the time to build up your practice. You can't just spring fully. I used to say this, but then Douglas Stewart came away and did this. The other Douglas Stewart, not the BMX Bandits, my Douglas Stewart, you know, won the Booker Prize on his first novel. I used to say nobody from Scotland would ever do that. But yeah, you need time to hone your craft and build it and make those mistakes. And it's about investing in your belief that is a good thing for your country to do, that your country needs that space to reflect upon itself.
It benefits everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I was invited over there, and me and Eddie Reader, and we were doing this sort of music in Scotland, music and writing Scottish thing at the Museum of Literature. They have a museum of Irish literature. You know, they've got statues of, I mean, I know we've got Robbie Burns, but you know, they've got for all the Robbie Burns statues, they've got as many of Oscar Wilde and James Joyce and Yeats, and they've got a whole museum just of Irish literature talking about how it tells its story. And that sort of reverence for the importance of a country's ability to reflect upon itself. That said, cost of living crisis, not totally sure that I feel, you know, sometimes I feel like we're not worth it for that. So, yeah.
But I think that was interesting the way you said that there, because I think there is a lot of that. There's a lot of embarrassment and kind of almost like self, like shame comes with the idea that, sorry, I'm an artist, sorry, I'm getting subsidised, sorry, Creative Scotland funded this, sorry. Like as if we have to apologise for. And I don't know if that goes back to something we talked about earlier about that sort of Calvinist attitude to flamboyance and showing off that kind of I can't your fear thing, sit back down type of thing. Grant, you're the new culture secretary. What's the big idea, the big policy idea?
I think, you know, it's also obvious. It's just like invest in your youth financially. It's like, you know, when the Olympics were, I think it was like the 2012 Olympics, was it? You know, like Britain won, you know, so many medals, and that's because they invested and, you know, nourished their youth, like, for that. You know, it's like for every, you know, football in, I don't know why I keep on talking about football because I know nothing about football, but, you know, like in Brazil, they invest in their football team. In, yeah, like New Zealand, they invest in their rugby team. And it shows like dividends. I think exactly as you're saying, like bring back the job seekers, you know, it's not job seekers allowance, but the income support for artists. Yeah. In the history of like music, when that was like cut out in like 1999, I think, was it, or like 2000, you know, it just evaporated the creativity because like young people and working class people can't afford to be artists, and like there's so much that had been created by,
yep.
And you know what it reaps back. You know, I'd rarely sort of quote anything that Liam or Noel Gallagher would say, but when they were on that scheme, they, you know, what was paid out to them in our benefits, they paid more back in like tax than like probably every single person that like paid for that.
I think it was the enterprise allowance,
enterprise loan scheme. That
you
was
got,
it.
I think you got £40 a week and your rent if you had a flat, but. It was that was at a time when £40 a week was probably worth like double or more sort of thing. So if you're a young guy, you know, you can afford to at least try be an artist if you're getting money. So understand me, the Gallaghers would have been in that position. They'd have been in a position where otherwise you would have went and get a job. You get a job, you get too tired, you end up it's just have a covers band and play the local pub and forget that idea about writing songs.
What they paid back in tax paid for pretty much every single person that was like on that, and it works. And also, like, you know, we were talking about like myth building earlier on. Take away that stigma, create like a myth that it's like good to be an artist, because like now I don't think people, they think it's like some kind of like wanky thing, and like they focus,
yeah,
on,
absolutely.
Oh no, there's like you know, a cost of living crisis, you know, which there is, but they don't have to be separate things. You can be an artist. You know, that's probably the best time to be an artist, to give people something to take them out of there.
That always happens in times of austerity and all that stuff. Artists are seen as an extra, like a non-essential and all that. But it's some of the people who are the loudest complainers about artists, or artists being middle class and all that. I think sometimes you actually just stop and think that, see that great song you just sung at the karaoke? An artist wrote that. Do you know what I mean? It's given you pleasure 500 miles away from where it was written 20 years later. You know what I mean? And it's cheered you up and it's gladdened your heart and it's made you feel great, and it's a piece of art. That's what it is.
Anything to make somebody happy for 3-5 minutes, isn't it? It's amazing.
And so this would be personally, I mean, I don't want to be too biased, but personally, in an independent Scotland, if I'm the president, this would be my cultural secretary, Kevin Peel Day. And so culture secretary, you can run with one big idea that will fund it no matter what it is.
I think I would introduce the get over yourself bill, which would be trying to instill confidence in the next generation to stop doing what we are talking about, of that embarrassment.
To move beyond the cringe, even.
Exactly. Because, yeah, I feel it all the time, because it's like, of course, it feels embarrassing. It's like, oh, you know, your dad used to work in the shipyards and you're writing poems. It's like, it's a riddy, as they would say. And it's hard work, like mentally hard work, to detach yourself from that and get over that and get to that place where you're comfortable and feel confident. And I don't think anybody teaches you that. I think the most people actually don't want you to succeed in doing that. And it would be really great to institute something so that we could tell the younger generation to not make the same mistakes, basically, and that this is as credible a job as any other job in the world, and it's necessary, and it's great, and it contributes to society. So, yeah, get on board.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So, I'm calling that bill Beyond the Cringe. I'm calling it. I'm going to put a, what'd you call that thing? Copyright one already. Just,
all yours.
Just in case. Just in case we get independence. Unlikely. And just in case you become the culture secretary, I'm grabbing it. That was, so I think we solved some of the problems. We got to some of the questions, at least to move on with to the next episodes. We'll be interested as we're going to be covering it subject by subject, but we'll come back to this. And I want all of you to be back on again at some time, you know, form a wee team of regular correspondents and all that stuff. So I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much for coming on. Thanks to Kevin Peagle-Day, Kirsten Innes and Grant McPhee.
Thank you, Jim.
Cheers.
Come on.
This has been a You Call That Radio production, powered by the patrons at patreon.com/YouCallThatRadio. Thanks to all the guests. Thanks to Jim. Thanks to Glad Radio, The Deep End and Govan Hill Baths for allowing us to use their studio. And join us next week for episode 2 of Beyond the Cringe.